Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 9 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
Well, today, Steve, we're going to attempt another topic at which at first glance seems, well, rather innocuous, but I have to say it's a bit of a mind-boggler, too. We're going to talk about mass and weight and how they relate and how they differ and the importance to missions in space. But before we do, as is our custom, a bit of an update or a fun little news item pertaining to, in this case, the Starship launch that happened in November of this year. For the second time in 2023, it blew up. What did happen was the first stage of the spacecraft blew up, and then there was a failure in the upper stage, well, actually led to a detonation. Now, interestingly enough, just like the previous instance in April of this year, a lot of people have been saying, hey, wait a minute, this was actually a success. And I had a little look into what they meant by that, Steve, and I think it's kind of fun. For one example, the spacecraft has a total of 33 Raptor rockets, and this is on the first stage. And back in April, several of them failed for quite different reasons. This time, all 33 worked on time and just as they were supposed to, and that's obviously a bit of success right there. A bigger success was the implementation of something called hot staging. Now, what they do here is it's not a brand new technology, but it hadn't been part of the Starship plan. Hot staging is where they decide to ignite the engines on the upper stage rocket before separation from the first stage. They basically blow it away and make sure it gets clear of the upper stage as it leaves for a higher orbit. And hopefully they believe that the initial stage, the first stage, will still ignite and return safely to be recycled for another launch. Incredibly, they were able to get this done in just 7 months, and it worked. And there's video online of this hot staging in action. It's really quite remarkable. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention as a huge success was the fact that the launch pad did not get blown to bits as it had in April. Now, way back in April, not that long ago, 7 or 8 months ago, the launch pad was just demolished during the first launch, much to the horror of the SpaceX folks. They had not installed a sound suppression system. And when you have rockets launching at this magnitude, you can get shock waves. And depending on the construction of the launch pad or the size of the shock waves, you can end up with tremendous damage. Now, this had been a system that had actually been first introduced in my research way back in the space shuttle STS-1, when they found that the shock waves from its launch resulted in about 15 lost thermal tiles and about another 150 that were damaged. So, I don't know, to get overly complicated, they spray water onto the launch pad as a way of dampening the sound and preventing those shock waves from doing too much damage. And it worked. So that's pretty impressive, too.
Well, I wish they could use that when some of the guys drive by with their beatboxes going in their cars. An interest.
That's a great idea. In fact, I might just try that. It's for point the hose at the car, perhaps.
Well, there we go. Well, that is all interesting, Tim. But with regard to today's topic of mass, I'm reminded of that childhood riddle. Which weighs more, a pound of feathers or a pound of lead?
Well, you know, we are using metric now, Steve. So that was adopted way back in 1970, some 53 years ago. So are we going to say a kilogram of feathers or a kilogram of lead?
Absolutely. And I clearly remember my childhood off-the-cuff response to that question being, well, of course, a kilo of lead weighs more, which was immediately followed by a 5-minute heated exchange of words and philosophies as best manifested by 9-year-olds as only they can, before a tiny light bulb began flickering in my mind.
You know, Steve, that mental challenge also brings back in memory for me a visual experiment that was carried out on the surface of the moon, actually. The experiment was conducted to see whether they could demonstrate Galileo's theory that in the absence of significant air resistance, objects of different weights would fall at the same rate under gravity. So I don't know if you remember astronaut David Scott. He was certainly one of my favorites, an amazing individual. He held out a geologic hammer in one hand and a falcon feather in the other, and he dropped them at the same time. So because the moon has no atmosphere, or precisely there was no air resistance to affect the falling objects, both the hammer and the feather hit the lunar surface simultaneously. And that, of course, was visual confirmation of Galileo's principle. Steve, I think you have an audio recording of that experiment, so let's have a listen.
A little time capsule going way back to August 2nd, 1971. Here we go.
Well, in my left hand, I have a feather. In my right hand, a hammer. And I guess one of the reasons we got here today was because of a gentleman named Galileo a long time ago, who made a rather significant discovery about falling objects in gravity fields. And we thought that where would be a better place to confirm his findings than on the moon. And so we thought we'd try it here for you. The feather happens to be appropriately a falcon feather for our falcon. And I'll drop the two of them here, and hopefully they'll hit the ground at the same time. How about that? Mr. Galileo was correct in his findings.
Now, before we go much further, listeners may have twigged to us rather interchanging the words weight and mass. And here's where our first clarification must take place. We've all heard of logic statements such as all dogs are animals, but not all animals are dogs.
So are you going to say something like all things have mass, but not all mass has weight?
And there you have it, Tim. We've all seen videos of astronauts sort of floating about in space, such as inside the International Space Station. And though those astronauts are weightless, their bodies still have mass.
Well, it's a subtle distinction, which isn't too hard to grasp. And many of us have, of course, viewed space videos where astronauts are performing those spacewalk activities, repairing something in the space station. And if you're old enough, you may have even seen them make repairs to the Hubble Space Telescope. However, while both the astronaut and telescope are weightless, they both retain their mass. And the typical mass of the astronaut with all that extracurricular vehicle gear is about 400 pounds or 180 kilograms. Meanwhile, the mass of the Hubble Space Telescope is a whopping 11,000 kilograms or 25,000 pounds. And that is a distinct disparity. But in space, orbiting the Earth, they both have zero weight.
That doesn't mean, though, that the astronaut could lift Hubble and hold it in his hand, even though it weighs nothing. Yes, you could put your hand on it, and it would appear that you're holding the telescope, but in reality, since you're not moving it and changing its position, you're not doing anything, and certainly no work, since by definition, work equals force times distance. In other words, if you apply a force to something and it doesn't move, you're doing no work.
Boy, it opens up the door to a few jokes here, but I'll use one spacey analogy for us. Let's say your buddy asks you over to move a couch from his van to his house. Of course, you show up and you lift up one end of that couch, waiting for him to join in and, well, help with the other end. But instead, you look across and there he is, sitting in the lawn chair, eating a sandwich. In desperation, you tell him, hey, get off your duff, get over here and get on with the work. But in reality, you're doing no work at all, even though you're holding up that one end of the couch, because it's not moving. Meanwhile, your so-called friend, he's sitting over there doing more work than you are, because he's constantly moving that sandwich to his face while adjusting himself to find the comfiest spot on that chair.
And that's just another graphic instance of noting that life isn't fair, Tim. Tim, I've noticed that any number of extravehicular spacewalk videos and seen that the astronauts want to undo a bolt, but first they must tether themselves and hold on to something. If they came up beside a massive object such as the Hubble Space Telescope and gave it a shove, the Hubble wouldn't budge, but the astronaut would. And that's what happens when a mere 180 kilos tries to move 11,000 kilos, even though they both weigh nothing. And so I think we've kind of reached our first base in this massive episode, and that's our first pun for today. Mass is the measure of the amount of stuff in an object and remains constant, whereas weight is the force exerted on that object due to gravity. and that weight varies by the strength of that gravitational field.
Yeah, let's digress a little bit here to emphasize how weight does change, but mass can remain and does remain a constant. You're standing on a bathroom scale at the top of the CN Tower, and it registers your weight as being slightly less than if you were on that same scale in the basement of the CN Tower.
See, that reminds me of the sensation one experiences in elevators.
When you press up and the elevator suddenly ascends, you get kind of scrunched as the floor moves upward, pressing on your feet, and momentarily you feel somewhat heavier. On the other hand, you get a queasy sensation when you're in that same elevator at the top of the building and you press the ground floor button. When the elevator descends, for a moment, you feel slightly lighter as you begin to fall downward.
There are lots of YouTube videos which vividly demonstrate this difference in elevator weight. And while reviewing a couple of them, I considered a scenario in a descending elevator. Now, if the shaft was long enough and the elevator descended quickly enough, your weight would drop to zero. And suddenly I realized I was thinking about Einstein's classic elevator mind experiment, which led to the development of his theory of general relativity.
Well, speaking of gravity, imagine what happens to your weight when you run off a high structure, such as, of course, the cliff that Wile E. Coyote does in the Roadrunner cartoons. As the coyote falls, its weight does go to zero. He's weightless, but his mass remains the same. And as they say, it isn't the fall which kills you, it's that sudden stop at the end. Conversely, your weight increases as you experience more gravitational force, which is something all airline passengers have experienced as their plane accelerates down the runway, though their experience is rather a mild one. Now, the typical extra force you'd experience would be 0.3 G added to the normal 1 G. To put some typical numbers in context here, if you're seated inside an airliner and you have a body weight of 100 kilograms, you're accelerating to takeoff, your weight would suddenly become 104 kilograms. It doesn't seem to become that, though, Steve. It actually does become that.
No, Tim, as a youngster, I remember watching a particular Air Force day at Porter's La Prairie. My dad had previously mentioned he was going to be putting on an aerobatic jet demonstration and at one point would be pulling 6 Gs during a tight turn. This meant that his normal weight of 70 kilograms, he wasn't a big man, would become 420 kilograms for a few brief moments. To be able to endure that increase requires much specific physical breath and muscle control training. And to further assist pilots, they wear G suits, which inflate under load to constrict blood flow and help the pilot maintain consciousness. And guess who invented the G suit? A Canadian, Dr. Wilbur Franks, way back in 1942. And I clearly remember seeing my dad outfitted in a G suit and was in awe of all the webbing and piping. Accolades must also go to the United States Air Force flight surgeon, Dr. John Stapp, who personally investigated G-force loads upon the human body during the early 1950s. He strapped himself into a rocket sled over a series of 29 incrementally fast test runs of rapid acceleration and deceleration on a specialized track. And finally, on December 10, 1954, he boarded a rocket sled nicknamed Sonic Wind 1, equipped with 9 rockets for his last experimental run. And since on this run there would be nothing to deflect the impending incredible wind velocity, his arms and legs were strapped down to keep them from thrashing about. And unlike his previous rides, this time he wore a helmet and used a bite block to prevent him from biting through his tongue. The rocket sled accelerated to 1,000 kilometers per hour, imparting 20 Gs of force to his body, increasing his weight by 20 times. And then the sled braked from 1,000 kilometers an hour to zero in a mere 1.4 seconds, forcing an instantaneous 46 Gs of force to his body, which for a moment weighed 3,200 kilograms, though of course his mass remained the same.
I understand that violent experimental ride would of course wreak huge havoc on his body, cracked ribs. I think it broke his wrists, if I'm not mistaken. He was blinded because all the blood vessels burst in both eyes, but amazingly, none of those injuries were permanent. And this ride set an official world land speed record, and it earned him that nickname, Fastest Man on Earth, from Time magazine. The data from Stapp's G-Force research, was also used to create safer military harness systems and ejection seats for jet pilots. STAP was instrumental in the adoption of mandatory seatbelt legislation, and the STAP car crash conference was inaugurated and continues to this day. And here's an interesting presentation from a recent such conference. It was titled The Development of Relaxed Seat Passenger Protection Airbag. I have no idea what that would look like.
STAP's experiments demonstrated that rearward-facing pilots could better endure high G loads and crash survivability. He advocated that airline seats and passengers should be facing backwards, but that was never adopted. But it did lead to astronauts lying on their backs during launch and return from space.
Well, STAP demonstrated that the human body can experience high G loads for brief periods of time, or slightly lower G loads for longer periods. And during the initial launch phase, the Apollo astronauts experienced 4G loads for about 2 minutes. NASA's fix was to build them individually molded seats. They would lay on their back, face upwards, if you will, and that was another tip of the hat to the work done by Colonel Stapp. Now, the next generation space shuttle astronauts experienced slightly lower 3G loads, but for 2 minutes. And on the new SpaceX Falcon launch, those astronauts are experiencing 3 to 4 Gs for about a minute and a half. But I'm going to note that the prize for the most brutal weight increases go to those poor astronauts and cosmonauts aboard the venerable Soyuz launch vehicles. They experience an incredible 4 to 5 G loads for 5 minutes.
So to summarize, astronauts experience weight gains while both accelerating and decelerating into space. Experience no weight as they literally constantly fall around the Earth, and the experience weight gain again as they decelerate back to Earth, but all the while, their mass stays the same.
That's not too much of an intellectual hurdle to overcome, but now let's consider a newborn baby and how it gains weight. And here's where the spacey stuff enters the discussion.
And we hasten to note that Space Talks has coined the term spacey stuff in a previous episode, and we're seeking copyright protection.
So we both know how that endeavor will end. Regardless, Einstein's famous E equals mc squared states that energy equals mass and mass equals energy. The only way for the newborn to gain mass or weight, loosely speaking, is to gain energy. And where does that energy come from? Food.
No mystery there. And that's exactly how, at my age, I gain weight, Tim. Food. Dieters are fully aware that the human body is exceptionally good at converting food energy into new masses of tissue, and that means a gain in weight.
Okay, Steve, it's time for us to tackle the really spacey part of mass and weight when it comes to space travel. Just how does a rocket work in the vacuum of space when we know that airplanes here are propelled by pushing against the surrounding medium, the molecules in our atmosphere? Those molecules in the air represent the mass, just as that Hubble spacecraft you mentioned earlier represented the mass that makes it difficult for an astronaut to move it around, despite being in a weightless environment.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Tim. The key bit of science here is Newton's third law of motion, pretty well known to everyone as simply this. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. When a rocket expels mass in one direction, the action, the rocket experiences a force in the opposite direction, the reaction. This is known as the conservation of momentum.
Okay, that's a pretty critical fact right there. And now we're going to go back to this discussion about how mass itself is acquired. Now, listeners may recall the scientific world got all excited back in 2012 with the discovery of the so-called God particle, which imparted mass and therefore weight to objects. For decades, British physicist Peter Higgs, among others, proposed the existence of this new subatomic boson particle, which would impart mass. At the risk of digressing, Steve, it's the little stories behind these science facts which intrigues us here on Space Talks, and the word boson is one of those. Now, the name boson was coined by the brilliant British physicist Paul Dirac to commemorate the contribution of the Indian physicist Satyendra Nath Bose, who developed in conjunction with Einstein the theory of such particles. Bose is rightly considered the father of the God particle, but he received scant recognition for his work.
That's right, Tim. And although seven scientists went on to be awarded the Nobel Prize for subatomic work, Bose was consistently ignored. Regardless, the particle was discovered by CERN's Large Hadron Collider and announced to the world on July 4th, 2012. Subsequently named after Peter Higgs, and the brilliant Satyendra Bose, the Higgs boson is now generally accepted as an important ingredient which gives certain subatomic particles their mass.
Wait a minute, Steve. I heard something there I want to pick you up on. You said the Higgs boson gives mass to certain subatomic particles, but not all?
You've read too much fine print, Tim. Here I was thinking I could slide that one by you. Subsequent analysis of the Higgs boson reveals that it imparts only 1% of an atom's mass. So the question is, where does the other 99% come from?
I'm having sympathy here for people listening to this show. They may have understood the first half of our episode as we discussed how weight is influenced by gravity and that energy and mass can be made into each other. But I'm afraid that the next part, it's going to be a little bit confusing.
You're right, and we're about to enter that dark realm which we had before of the more I know, the less I know.
A common expression around these parts, absolutely. Now, listeners may recall in the last episode we discussed the beginning of the universe and the so-called Big Bang, where energy from an amazingly small dot or singularity expanded outward in all directions.
Yes, and this is the something from nothing theory, which is not well understood until you realize a couple of simple concepts. Let's say, for example, you have $5 and you spend $5. You have nothing. Similarly, when the universe was created, there was positive and negative energy, which canceled out each other. And this exists today. So if you add up all the positive energy and all the negative energy and balance them out, the result is zero. The total energy in the universe, which includes everything you can think of, you, me, Earth, the Milky Way galaxy, your pet dog, Fido, is equally balanced by negative energy.
Well, I get the money analogy, but I'm having a little hard time with the negative energy. Positive energy, I can understand. What is this negative energy then?
Well, positive energy is matter comprised of mass. As mentioned, those material things you can think of like the solar system, all the people on Earth, all the aliens on Rigel 3. On the other hand, negative energy is gravity.
Okay, if that's the case in a closed and static universe, negative energy and positive energy equal out. But current cosmology doesn't support that concept of zero energy since we appear to have an expanding universe. But my question remains, how do the atoms which make up our bone and skin cells, for example, gain their mass?
That mass comes from energy in what is a most unusual way. Inside each proton, which scientists used to think were indivisible, are three quarks which are bound together by what is called the strong nuclear force. And these three quarks spin around each other and in doing so create mass, which weighs something.
Now, just a second, Steve. Don't those three quarks themselves have mass and therefore weigh something?
Well, yes, they do. But if you add up the three quarks, their mass is just 1% of the total proton's mass. Where's the other 99%? Well, it's kind of like buying a box of cereal. Let's say it's a box of Cheerios. On the box's label, it says that the contents weigh 800 grams, and you open it up and you pour out the Cheerios to a scale, and it only measures 8 grams. Where in the heck is the other 792 grams?
They're calling that shrinkflation these days, but it's not a packaging problem, though. What is accounting for this?
Well, so if you pour the Cheerios back into the box, it weighs 800 grams. You pour them out, it's only 8.
Not a magic trick. It's pretty counterintuitive. So we must be talking about something here like quantum mechanics, where two things can be in the same place at the same time?
It's something like that, Tim. Now, I'm hardly a reference source, so let's have a listen to Anton Petrov, who we mentioned last episode, as he tries to explain how the movements of the quarks inside a proton create mass. And by the way, we've already referenced the CERN complex this episode, and Petrov will mention another superb particle physics organization called the Jefferson Lab, located in Virginia. Let's have a listen to Petrov as he talks about the strong nuclear force inside protons.
When the scientists a few decades ago started to measure the mass of these quarks, specifically the up quarks and down quarks separately, they quite shockingly discovered that the up quarks and down quarks only represent a tiny fraction of the total mass. So where is the mass from? With the work from the Jefferson Lab right here, more or less answering this once and for all. 99% of all of the mass in the universe, and we're talking about mass inside various stars, inside various gas clouds, and in pretty much most of the objects out there, comes from. And the actual answer and the result are kind of counterintuitive and somewhat difficult to understand. This mass comes from the energy connecting and holding the quarks together. It's really these gluons that create pretty much all of the mass around us. Not Higgs boson, not the tiny quarks inside of our bodies, but the strong force holding them together.
Okay, well, that was pretty interesting. Let's go back to that box of Cheerios, though. What you're saying is that the quantum level, when you pour the 8 grams of cereal into the box, they start swirling about and somehow create another 792 grams of Cheerios out of seemingly nothing but energy. That's going to hurt my brain for a while, Steve. But as we said before, science doesn't care what we think, or indeed, I guess, what we can understand.
You know, Tim, it's sort of like trying to explain to your dog who looks at you lovingly and who only sees in monochrome that an orange is called an orange because of its color. The dog doesn't understand it, but you do, and that's a reality.
Our brains were never purposed to understand the quantum. Rather, they were programmed to be aware of sounds in the night and animals making loud sounds and showing pointy teeth. It's amazing we've progressed as far as we have when you think about it. So to recap this episode about mass, it's not the same as weight, which is a variable dependent upon the force of gravity acting upon it. Your weight can change, but not your mass. The objects, such as ourselves, get the vast majority of their mass from subatomic particles containing extreme amounts of potential and kinetic energy, whizzing about inside of each atomic nucleus, which makes up our bodies. Really, we're just walking, talking bundles of energy and not actually flesh and blood.
I know. This sounds exactly like a grade 5 G-Wiz science fiction book, but that's what the scientists state as they continue to experiment and publish their results for others to replicate and either validate or dispute. And there's no disputing the mass of nucleons.
So, Steve, we're just about at the end of this show, and I'm going to rush out to buy a box of Cheerios and see what I can figure out. So that's all the time we have on this episode about mass. This is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, let me see what spring like.